Mr. Williams, I'm sorry we're running short of time for this program. Allow me to thank my guest, author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, joining us from London. Also thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy In Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Iran begins 10-day celebrations to mark the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian following an alleged knife attack near the occupied West Bank city of Beit Lehem. Also ahead, a row over the coronavirus vaccine's rollout in the EU deepens as Germany threatens legal action over delays in deliveries. Welcome to the program. January the 31st marks the beginning of 10-day celebrations marking the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution of 1979 in Iran. Every year, Iranians commemorate the occasion by holding ceremonies and events nationwide. This year as well, people are remembering the occasion. On February the 1st, 1979, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, returned home from exile. He led Iranians struggle against the tyranny of the time, the revolution that is finally emerged victorious on February the 1st, the same year, ending the dictatorial rule of the Pahlavi regime. Well, on that anniversary, I'm going to bring in Youssef Jalali. He is our man in Tehran who joins us via phone. He's going to tell us where he is and what he sees. Youssef, over to you.
Well, Ash, I'm at the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini, some 10 kilometers south of the capital, Tehran. And here, people are, of course, marking the 42nd anniversary of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. It's a very historic day for Iran and for the people of Iran, actually. It marks the homecoming of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, some 42 years ago. And of course, after several years of exile enforced upon Imam Khomeini by the former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. So it is a very important occasion for Iranians every year. On such a day, people gather at the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini in different locations across the country to celebrate the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Of course, it's called the 10-day dawn here, or Dahiye Fajr, which starts on February the 1st or January 31st and ends on February 11th. It's a 10-day period during which Iranians from all walks of life celebrate the victory of the Islamic Revolution, get to know about the personality of Imam Khomeini, why the revolution transpired and led to the overthrow of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. So it is actually a way to pass on the ideals of the Islamic Revolution to the new generations. And people from different generations, of course, take part in such ceremonies to get acquainted with the personality of Imam Khomeini and what happened and what led to, of course, the start of the revolution and what led to the overthrow of the former Iranian monarch. So to Iranians, this is a day to remember the struggle for independence, because Iranians believe that the Shah was heavily dependent on the West. Iranian oil industry was heavily dependent on Western powers such as the United States and the UK. And with the Islamic Revolution, with the Islamic Republic, with the establishment of a new political system based on independence and Islamic values, they, of course, reached a level of independence. And that is why Iranian officials claim that the ideals of the Islamic Revolution do not have an expiry date. And that is what has led to the Iranian people supporting this political system still after four decades, because these people did not want to be dependent on the West. They were fed up with the Shah's heavy dependence on the United States. They believe that the Shah was handpicked by Western government, and they did not want this to be the case in their country. That is what why they, of course, supported Imam Khomeini at the time, and here they are after four decades. They're still participating in such ceremonies to mark the occasion. And this year, of course, the occasion is marked differently amid the coronavirus pandemic. We see that fewer number of people have participated in the event due to the coronavirus pandemic and the social distancing issues. Of course, this time, the 10-day period is going to be celebrated differently. Of course, we've been hearing from the Iranian officials that there will be some symbolic ceremonies without the participation of the public, like motorcycle parades, which is later to be held in the Iranian Mehrabad airport, which hosted Imam Khomeini 42 years ago after he arrived in the country, and millions of people participated to welcome his arrival. Such ceremonies are going to continue for 10 days to mark the 10-day dawn.
Okay, I believe that we're going to hear more from you within the next 10 days, without a doubt, Yusuf. But for now, let me just say goodbye to you, and we're going to get back to you as soon as we have something else going on your neck of the woods. That was Yusuf Jalali, our man in Tehran, with that report. Let's just move on to another story now. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The Israeli army said the Palestinian died of his wounds after troops shot him at close range at a bus station in the Gush Etzion area south of Bethlehem. The army claimed the man had tried to stab the troops. Israeli troopers frequently shoot Palestinians, citing similar allegations across the occupied territories. Gush Etzion has been a flashpoint of such attacks. On January the 5th, Israeli soldiers shot dead another Palestinian in the area. To find out more on that story, I'm going to bring in Mona Kandil. She joins us via Skype, our correspondent in Ramallah. Mona, if you hear me, please tell us what we have learned from the incident so far.
Well, Until the moment, it's the story from the Israeli military. According to the Israeli army, a Palestinian man was seen running towards an Israeli soldier standing outside the bus station at Gush Atzion, south the occupied city of Bethlehem. Immediately, the soldier responded quickly and opened fire, shoot him. The Israeli army said the man was neutralized. This means that he was shot and killed at the spot. The Palestinian Ministry of Health confirmed that they were informed by the Palestinian liaison that a Palestinian man was shot dead at the Gush Atzion junction. However, his identity was not known yet. The Israelis claimed that the man was attempting to use a knife. It's a attempted knife stabbing, according, of course, to the Israeli soldier. However, none of the Israeli soldiers were injured in this attack. As you were saying, the Gush Atzion junction is very important. It's in the middle area leading to Bethlehem, to Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. And at the same time, it's the center of a number of numerous Israeli settlements around the area on the mountains. And there is a number of Israeli soldiers. They day and night, they stop Palestinian vehicles. They prevent people to enter their villages and towns at the same time to facilitate and make the life of the Israeli settlers there more comfortable and easy.
All right, many, many thanks. That's our correspondent in that part of the world, Mona Candil. I appreciate that update. Moving on to another story now, Israelis have held a fresh demonstration against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside his residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. Demonstration was held despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies over the past months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are corruption charges facing the Prime Minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but he denies any wrongdoing. And now an explosion has rocked a Turkish-occupied city in Syria's northern province of Aleppo, killing six civilians, including three children. The deadly incident occurred when an explosive-laden vehicle was, or actually went off near the base of Turkish-affiliated militants in Afrin City. More than two dozen civilians were also wounded in the explosion. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the death toll could rise. Afrin and other Turkish-occupied areas in northern Syria are regularly hit by such bombings. In January 2018, Ankara launched a cross-border military operation inside Syria with the declared aim of driving out Syrian Kurdish militants from Afrin. Germany has threatened to take legal action against pharmaceutical companies that failed to deliver coronavirus vaccines to the European Union on schedule. Economy Minister Peter Altmaier also warned, quote, no company can favor another country over the EU. This comes after the announcement by the British-Swedish firm AstraZeneca that it can only deliver a quarter of the vaccines promised to the EU in the first quarter of the year. The company said this is due to problems at its labs in Belgium. It also said that vaccines produced in its Britain-based labs would be exclusively distributed in the UK. Brussels has implicitly accused AstraZeneca of giving preferential treatment to Britain at the expense of the EU. Italy has permanently halted arms exports to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates amid concerns over the two Arab countries' continued war crimes in Yemen, Max Civelli reports.
Italy's government's decision to block exports of arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates over the ongoing bloodshed in Yemen has been hailed by activists and several Italian lawmakers. The move comes after 2 years of parliamentary activity and lobbying by humanitarian organizations. In 2018, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte indicated his government's intention to end arms sales to Riyadh over its involvement in the onslaught on Yemen and the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Let me start by saying that this is a historic achievement. I and Ms. Quartapelle were the first signatories of a resolution that has permanently revoked approval for arms exports to Saudi Arabia and UAE. This is a clear message of peace coming from our country.
The government did the right thing, even though its decision will affect about 200 workers from a German factory located in a depressed Italian region. The German weapons maker is to sue our country over the decision to stop all arms exports to Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, a blockade should have been already imposed long ago.
The government's decision will halt the sale of almost 13,000 Italian-made missiles to Saudi Arabia. The blocked sales were part of total export of 20,000 missiles worth over 400 million euros agreed in 2016 under the government headed by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. Renzi is currently facing criticism for participating in Saudi Arabia's Future Investment Initiative conference and holding a conversation with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, during which he described the prince as his friend. He has said the monarchy could be the place of a new renaissance for the future.
Matteo Renzi's reputation in politics is one of ruthlessness. In 2014, he pledged then Prime Minister and fellow party member Enrico Letta that he wouldn't anyhow hinder the government, only to shortly afterward orchestrate Letta's downfall. Renzi then became Prime Minister himself. About 2 weeks ago, Renzi triggered the government crisis by abruptly pulling his small Italia Viva party out of the ruling coalition.
According to Italian media, Renzi earns $80,000 a year as a member of Saudi Arabia's Future Investment Initiatives Advisory Board, Max Civili, Rome.
The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the United States has surpassed the 26 million mark. According to Johns Hopkins University, over 438,000 Americans have also died of the virus. Data shows the first month of 2021 has been the country's deadliest since the start of the pandemic, with nearly 91,000 fatalities. The United States, the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic, is struggling to contain the spread of new strains of the novel coronavirus. Maryland has become the second U.S. state to report a more transmissible variant first identified in South Africa. On Thursday, South Carolina also reported two cases of the strain. The developments come as wearing masks on conveyances has been mandated from February 1st by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Roni Carvalho says the surge in COVID-19 infections in the U.S. mainly has to do with the government's mishandling of the pandemic.
We had the 26 million cases so far. But it's very interesting to understand how the first 13 million happened. It took 365 days, a year, for the first 13 million. But for the second 13 million people, it was just 64 days. So it's narrowing. So the number increases dramatically. Brazil and United States, or United States and Brazil, they have the same problem. And basically, you have the same behavior of the government. So they are not accepting the virus. They are in denial of the virus. They ask people to take the different medication that was not approved by the scientists. So that at the beginning was the main cause. And then, of course, their followers was not obeying the mask, the distancing, keeping distance from each other, and not following the directions of the Minister of Health of those two countries that I mentioned, especially here in the United States.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose government came into power over 2 years ago, promising to come down hard on endemic corruption, is now itself in hot water after Transparency International slipped the country by 4 points on corruption index. On that story, we have Javed Rana reporting.
The government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has come under fire after International Corruption Perceptions Index slipped Pakistan by 4 points. It has come as an embarrassment for a government which came into power in 2018 with a key promise to bring an end to the rampant corruption in Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan argued that the data given in the Transparency International report belonged to the period when the opposition parties were in power, something denied by the opposition.
The date given in the findings of Transparency International is of 2019 and 2020. The data reveals that Pakistan, in fact, has slipped by 7 points since this government came into power. It indicates that this government has not only turned out to be the most incompetent, but also the most corrupt government Pakistan ever had.
The Transparency International's Perception Index ranked Pakistan at 124th position out of 180 countries. Most of the MPs, ministers, and advisors of the current government joined the ruling party not long before general elections in 2018. A significant number of them from the opposition parties, and many among them were tainted with the corruption charges. Public perception in Pakistan is that Prime Minister Imran Khan himself is not financially corrupt, unlike many of his predecessors. However, media reports indicate that many of his close associates were allegedly involved in wheeling and dealing in a country where anti-graft watchdog least punish allegedly corrupt officials, ministers, advisors, and powerful retired military generals. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای قوم که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
A new report headed by New York Attorney General Letitia James has found that the New York Department of Health underreported deaths due to COVID-19 in the state's nursing homes by approximately 50%. We have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Sharon Zhang, writer. This article is published under the heading New York may have underreported COVID deaths at nursing homes by 50%. Stay tuned for the details of this article. A new report headed by New York Attorney General Letitia James has found that the New York Department of Health underreported deaths due to COVID-19 in the state's nursing homes by approximately 50%. The state health department has reported over 8,600 nursing home deaths due to COVID so far. The 76-page report released recently is the product of ongoing investigation into allegations of neglect of coronavirus protocols in nursing homes in the U.S. The report says that lack of compliance with COVID-19 safety guidelines, understaffing, and poor government guidance may have contributed to high death counts as well as underreporting. The report is preliminary and so far is only reflective of a fraction of nursing homes in the New York State. However, James' office finds that in many cases, there is a discrepancy between what the state health department and nursing homes reported and what the Attorney General's office found in surveys. Because of the way that Governor Andrew Cuomo and the state chose to report nursing home deaths, the data published by the state health department may have been skewed. Andrew Cuomo came under fire last year for obscuring nursing home COVID death toll by reporting them differently from many other states with major outbreaks. New York only counted a nursing home death as such if it occurred at the facility. If the nursing home resident died after being transported to the hospital, the state did not count it as a nursing home death. Some have speculated that the deaths were reported this way
In order to make it seem like the state and Governor Cuomo was doing better than it was during New York's historic COVID outbreak last year. A similar investigation by the Associated Press found that between June and July last year, the state may have underreported nursing home deaths by as much as 65%. To make matters more complicated, Cuomo's record on nursing homes during the pandemic has already been tainted by a controversial decision he made last March, which effectively forced nursing homes to accept COVID patients from hospitals after they had supposedly recovered. A ProPublica investigation found that the decision likely caused more deaths than would have occurred had the facilities been allowed to not accept these patients. James' report further found that state laws on reimbursement may have also allowed for-profit nursing homeowners to line their own pockets instead of buying needed medical equipment for their facilities, even as understaffed facilities struggle to care for patients, which may have led to more deaths due to failures in the care provided. Through a variety of related party transactions and relationships, owners and investors of for-profit nursing homes can exert control over the facility's operations in a manner that extracts significant profit for them, while leaving the facility with insufficient staffing and resources to provide the care that residents deserve, the report reads. Now, after nearly a full year since the pandemic hit the United States of America, nursing homes across the country are facing a financial crisis. A new report by the American Healthcare Association and the National Center for Assisted Living finds that over 65% of nursing homes have said that they are at risk of closing within a year due to costs brought on by the pandemic. The pandemic has also taken a huge mental toll on many nursing home residents, which James' report says is reflective of poor compliance with government guidance in some nursing homes. As the pandemic and investigations continue, it is imperative that we understand why the residents of nursing homes in New York unnecessarily suffered at such an alarming rate, said James in a statement. While we cannot bring back the individuals we lost to this crisis, this report seeks to offer transparency that the public deserves and to spur increased action to protect our most vulnerable residents, he added. But the problem is not just the potential underreporting of COVID-related deaths at nursing homes. Inconsistent reporting and a depth of testing in some places means that it will likely take years, if ever, to understand the full death toll that COVID has taken across the U.S. An excess death tracker by The Economist, which compares deaths during COVID with previous pandemic-free baselines, finds that there may be up to 85,000 deaths due to COVID that have not been counted as such in the United States of America.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In one of the Trump administration's final acts, the United States has labeled Yemen's Houthi movement, or Ansar Allah, as a foreign terrorist organization. This label has serious implications for a country that is already suffering greatly from years of war and genocide at the hands of the Saudi-led coalition supported by the West. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Since 2015, Yemen has been gripped by war. The Houthi movement, also known as Ansar Allah, has been fighting against the Yemeni government, backed by a Saudi-led coalition, which includes the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. The country has also been plagued by the presence of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which has taken advantage of the war-torn country to wreak havoc. It's important to note here that the Saudi-led coalition has enjoyed tremendous support from the West in its bombing campaign of Yemen. For many years, the United States has sold astronomical amounts of weaponry to the Saudi kingdom, effectively supporting its relentless bombing campaigns in Yemen after gaining air supremacy over the country. Since Barack Obama took office, in a series of deals, he has sold Saudi Arabia roughly $115 billion worth of weapons, including other military equipment and training. Over 40 different deals, including tanks, warships, helicopters, and much more. When Donald Trump took office after him, he not only maintained U.S. support for the war in Yemen, but also increased arms exports to Saudi Arabia. In 2017, Trump set up one of the largest arms deals in history, which over 10 years would amount to up to $350 billion in weapons for the Saudis. Even until the very last minute in December of 2020, Trump was still pushing arms deals to the Saudis as his term was about to end. The United Kingdom has also played its part in this terrible genocide. Weapons manufacturers like BAE Systems and Raytheon UK make bombs in the United Kingdom, which they then sell to Saudi Arabia to be used in Yemen. According to John Devereaux, a former defense attaché to Saudi Arabia and Yemen, he said they couldn't do it without us, highlighting the instrumental role that Britain plays in fueling this genocide against the Yemeni people. The United Kingdom has also provided thousands of contractors who give in-country training to the Saudis. And as we recently learned, the UK has provided training to 100 Saudi Arabian pilots directly at Air Force bases inside of Great Britain. Simultaneously, France and Germany have also sold billions of weapons to the Saudi Arabian regime, raking in enormous sums and profiting off of the misery and destruction of Yemen. All of this combined has actually made Saudi Arabia the world's largest importer of weapons and, frankly speaking, the largest exporter of terrorism. Just from these bombs alone, thousands of civilians have already been killed. In one instance, 130 civilians were massacred in an airstrike while attending a wedding in 2015. Cluster bombs have continued to kill and maim innocent children. Human Rights Watch and other NGOs and relief agencies have noted the Saudi-led coalition's continued pattern in bombing fishing boats and fishing villages, which are civilian targets and constitute war crimes. In addition to weapon sales, we've also seen the U.S. intervene directly in the conflict, carrying out aerial bombardments and drone strikes. During his tenure, Obama was dubbed the drone striker-in-chief due to how many civilians were killed in his horrific drone program. At one point, he even ordered a drone strike which killed a U.S. citizen of Yemeni descent who was 16 years old. When pressed about the incident, his top advisor justified the killing by saying the boy should have had a more responsible father. Then when Donald Trump took over, he murdered the same boy's sister in another operation. Trump continued to support the war in Yemen, dropping even more bombs than Obama did during his time in office. This shows us that one feature all U.S. presidents seem to have in common is the disregard for human life and a love for the military-industrial complex. While a lot of the deaths in this conflict are the result of military operations, many of them have been the result of malnutrition, disease, and other preventable conditions, which makes it all the more heartbreaking. The United Nations warned that since the conflict broke out in 2015, conditions in the country have steadily collapsed, resulting in internal displacement, food insecurity, and cholera outbreaks. A report from the United Nations Humanitarian Office put Yemen's death toll at 233,000, mostly from indirect causes. According to the OCHA, the war had already caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from indirect causes such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Hostilities have directly caused tens of thousands of civilian casualties. Over 3,000 child deaths and over 5,000 children were verified in the first 5 years of the conflict. And 1,500 civilian casualties were reported in the first 9 months of 2012. As numerous NGOs and relief agencies have described the crisis in Yemen as the worst humanitarian situation in the world. In July 2020, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, almost two-thirds of Yemenis do not have food, and around the same amount have no health care. Equally, they warned that a majority of Yemenis are without clean water, and 11% suffer from acute malnutrition. Already in 2017, it was noted that the cholera outbreak in Yemen was the largest ever recorded in history, with over a million cases. According to UNICEF, 12.2 million children are in need of humanitarian aid, and 24 million people are in need, but aid agencies can barely keep up, as their funding goals aren't being met. As a result of this, the United Nations had to shut down several essential clinics, with more at risk of being closed. Lisa Grande, humanitarian coordinator for Yemen, said in August 2020 that half of all the UN's major programs in Yemen are impacted by this lack of funding. Already 12 of the UN's 38 major programs are shut or drastically reduced. These last years of wars have taken a tremendous toll on the Yemeni population. The Bush administration destabilized the Middle East with its war on terror. Then Obama and Trump took over, lending their military and logistical support to the Saudi-led coalition and even participating in this massacre of the Yemeni people. And on top of it all, what does the U.S. regime do? In his final days as Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo declares that he will be designating the Houthi movement as a foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global terrorist entity. This sadistic, cowardly move by the Trump regime received widespread condemnation from virtually everyone, NGOs, relief agencies, and even U.S. politicians. One statement from U.S. Senator Todd Young condemned the move, saying that with this designation, the world's worst man-made humanitarian disaster will go from bad to worse. Lives of innocent Yemenis and our own national security hangs in the balance. One of the relief agencies working in Yemen, Save the Children, made it clear that the U.S. terrorism designation threatens children's lives and places thousands of children at further risk of starvation and disease. With 80% of the Yemeni population living under Houthi territory, designating the Houthi government as a terrorist organization means that the overwhelming majority of Yemenis will suffer even more. These sanctions will make it harder to import food, medicine, and other critical supplies. Mark Lovecock, the United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator, gave his comments on the situation in Yemen earlier this month and made very clear how sanctions would impact civilians, making it harder for them to buy food and further worsening the humanitarian situation, which is already in tatters.
Yemen imports 90% of its food, and that nearly all that food is brought in through commercial channels. Aid agencies give people vouchers or cash to buy commercially imported food in the market. Aid agencies cannot, they simply cannot, replace the commercial import system. Already, Yemenis are crowding into markets and shops to stockpile whatever they can afford. Families are terrified that no more food or other supplies will make it into the country. Some suppliers, banks, insurers, and shippers are ringing up their Yemeni partners and saying they now plan to walk away from Yemen altogether. What is the likely humanitarian impact? The answer is a large-scale famine on a scale that we have not seen for nearly 40 years.
Although the United States pretends that these sanctions will only affect a few individuals, this is simply not true. The reality is that sanctions dissuade third parties from engaging in trade and commerce with the entire country. People working in trade and finance and commerce will be more reluctant to do business with Yemen for fear of being fined or placed on a list by the U.S. Sanctions also make it much harder for Yemen to obtain foreign currency, most notably U.S. dollars. And since roughly half of transactions in the world take place in dollars, this means being cut off from a very significant portion of the market. As Janti Sarepto, the president and CEO of Save the Children, says, with this new policy, the Trump administration has effectively prohibited certain interactions with the de facto authorities in the north. Many fear that businesses such as banks and shippers will avoid working in Yemen for fear of violating U.S. law, resulting in widespread shortages of food, fuel, and other essential medicines. Yemen is a country that already imports most of its food, hence why it is vital for them to have access to foreign currencies and be able to do trade, especially when the majority of food doesn't come through aid or relief agencies. Although the United States claims its sanctions don't target humanitarian endeavors and outlines exemptions for relief, we know this simply doesn't translate into reality. In the case of Syria, for example, the United States said the same thing in its Caesar Act sanctions, and one can see how that's going. The currency is in free fall, the economy is plummeted, and people are forming bread lines, queuing up for hours every day in a country that was once self-sufficient and a net exporter of wheat. And even then, Syria, despite everything, was still in a somewhat slightly better position. Yemen is unfortunately not so lucky and has been neglected and forgotten by the world. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now to talk more is Runi Agarhus, who's co-founder and general director of the Yemen Solidarity Council. It's good to have you on. Thanks for taking the time. So can I get your initial reaction to the United States designating Ansarullah, the Houthi movement, as a terrorist organization?
The designation is unfounded, based on plenitude of immoral and false allegations that has been going around about the movement for at least the past 5-6 years, or even earlier on, like 10 years, that the movement is a quote-unquote Iranian proxy, which is totally unfounded and baseless, really, to be honest. We were expecting it, as were plenty of people, but it's still unfortunate, and it's sad that, given the fact that all the implications and complications that the designation will make, it will only make things worse for 85% of the Yemeni population.
The Yemen Solidarity Council put out a statement saying it would be ceasing all operations in the U.S. and putting a temporary hold on fundraising. How is this designation going to impact your work and humanitarian endeavors in Yemen?
Considering the fact that the Ansarullah, the popular liberation movement Ansarullah, is now on the U.S. Foreign terrorist organization list, we cannot continue operating in the United States specifically, because we are, in fact, enjoying of a very intimate mutual relationship with the authorities in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. So already there you could see complications with us doing any work in the United States, because we would be liable to prosecution.
In the statement that was released by Mike Pompeo, it says the United States will make an exemption for relief agencies and humanitarian work, but they said the same thing about Syria, and we know how that turned out. So do you think this exemption will actually translate into reality, especially given that most food in Yemen is imported?
That's a good question, actually. The Department of the Treasury recently released a bunch of documents detailing these exemptions, but we find them totally useless and doesn't correspond nor translate into reality, dealing with what is needed at the moment for the Yemeni people. So the exemptions are totally useless we cannot possibly, as if the Red Cross and Save the Children and Doctors Without Borders have been criticizing the designation and the subsequent exemptions that have now been released and made public.
What do you expect to see from the Biden administration, given that Joe Biden has been inaugurated, his Secretary of State Blinken has been confirmed? They said that they would be reviewing this designation. Do you have any hope in regards to that being overturned, and how hard is it to actually get that removed?
The designation being overturned, simple as. That is all we are demanding, and that is all we are hoping for now, because as I've mentioned previously, this designation is based on unfounded and false accusations made in a vague attempt to push hard against Iran. That was the Trump administration's policy. But all it did was pushing hard on suffering Yemeni people that are already starving and have been starving for the past 5 to 6 years. So definitely overturn the this designation, and we are skeptical of if Biden really withdraw U.S. support from the Saudi-American coalition, because undoubtedly the war was a Biden-Obama war to begin with. But for a start, I think overturning this designation would prove helpful and useful to the suffering poor of the Yemeni population.
Why is that? Why are we seeing such negligence and lack of attention from the international community towards Yemen?
I think it has a lot to do with the media neglect of the war, the lack of coverage, the lack of adequate coverage. That is very important. We have been hearing a lot about the Saudi American coalition, quote-unquote, intervening in Yemen to, at some point they make it seem like they're dropping bombs on Yemeni civilians, hospitals and weddings to save Yemen from this perceived ghost of Iranian influence, when in fact the Iranian influence in Yemen is so minimal. It's highly over-dramatized and exaggerated to a point of it becoming obscure and dumb, in lack of a better word. The media organizations, the mainstream media conglomerates and corporations in the West have been not only failing to cover the war in Yemen from a somewhat objective standpoint, but they've also been getting a lot of, or basing a lot of their coverage on Saudi-paid, Saudi-funded narratives that the majority of Yemeni people fundamentally disagree with. So it has a lot to do with the narratives being spun on the war. There's a lot of false narratives, a lot of over-exaggerated narratives on the war currently.
In the statement from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he says that the United States has already given hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to the Yemeni people. I've also seen Saudi Arabia pledge some money. Isn't that a bit hypocritical when they're the ones bombing Yemen? What do you make of that?
The I think it's called the KSA Relief have been funding and driven this huge PR stunt to really show the world how good-hearted people they are and how much they are helping, and not only that, their military campaign is helping the Yemeni people, and their aid is helping the Yemeni people, and the U.S. aid is also doing all sorts of stuff to help the starving poor of the Yemeni people. Fact of the matter is that the majority Yemeni population, that is 85%, they don't see just 1 centimeter, just 1 ounce of any of this aid that is supposedly being donated to them out of supposed goodwill and good-heartedness. a lot of the aid, a lot of the foreign aid is being donated to militia groups in occupied Aden and Hadramaut and all other Yemeni or Saudi-occupied Yemeni regions. And most of these funds and most of the aid goes to wealthy warlords that have been terrorizing the local population for 6 years now in the occupied territories. Yemeni intelligence found a huge weapon cache of foreign weapons and missile systems and rocket-propelled grenades bearing the USA logos, meaning, of course, as concluded by the Yemeni intelligence director, that the USA claims to be giving humanitarian aid to the Yemeni people while really funneling arms and money into known terrorist groups that have been blacklisted practically everywhere. So it's a farce. It's a way for the occupiers and the aggressors to say, oh, we might be bombing your weddings, we might be destroying your homes, or bombing your funerals, or bombing your water sanitation systems, or bombing your critical infrastructure, or bombing your precious farms. But hey, we give you tons of money in aid and humanitarian donations. It doesn't add up. And any people with just the tiniest of peanut brains would understand that it doesn't make sense, and it's most likely a lie, a flat-out lie to continue legitimizing military aggression on innocent people.
Thanks so much for coming on. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
It's a pleasure to be joining you.
The Biden administration has indicated that it would possibly review the terrorist designation. However, in order to remove it, this would be quite difficult for Biden, and his cabinet would have to make the case for the Houthi movement, something that doesn't seem too likely, in all honesty. However, we all know that if the U.S. is really bent on doing something, they'll get it done. If the Biden administration is prepared to see thousands of Yemenis dying of starvation, and they're okay with that, and don't do everything within their power to prevent it, then this will be an indictment on them. We shouldn't forget that this conflict began during the Obama years when Biden was vice president. He, along with many members of his cabinet, who were also in government at the time, must be held accountable for this. For them to come around now after all these years and pretend to care is not something I really believe, nor have they really expressed any real remorse or commitment to ending support for Saudi Arabia and helping the Yemeni people rebuild. Just to give you one example, Avril Haines, who Biden appointed as National Director of Intelligence, she used to be the Deputy Director of the CIA under Obama. She also helped author the legal framework for Obama's drone program, killing scores of civilians, many of them in Yemen. It is truly imperative that something be done about this situation in Yemen. Not only has the United States and its allies sold weapons to Saudi Arabia and helped them commit genocide in Yemen, but the U.S. has really put the final nail in the coffin with this latest terrorist designation. This move accomplishes absolutely nothing except inflicting more suffering on the Yemeni people. It is a cruel, sadistic move, and typical for someone like Mike Pompeo, who spent the majority of his time as Secretary of State slapping Iran, Syria, and Venezuela with more sanctions than one can fathom as part of Trump's maximum pressure campaign, which, again, accomplishes nothing and only ends up inflicting immeasurable suffering on the innocent all over the world. The war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis that has come about as a result of this armed conflict is an indictment on all the countries who supported this Saudi-led genocide. What does it say about the world if we allow this to continue? It is really difficult to encapsulate just how horrified and disgusted I am by this war and the humanitarian situation that has ensued. The hands of the United Kingdom, the United States, France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Canada, they are covered in blood. What is happening in Yemen is absolutely disgraceful. And we must never forget the leaders who enabled and fueled this disaster. And equally, those who stood idly by and did nothing when they could and should have. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the U.S. has carried out at least 336 drone strikes in Yemen between 2004 and 2020. The strikes, which spanned three presidential administrations, have killed as many as 1,389 people, including up to 225 civilians, among them 44 to 50 children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for Jordan by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Yemeni Families File Petition Against U.S. for Unlawful Killing of Scores of Relatives. Stay tuned for the details of this.